This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. We know that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is big news here at home. But this week's special Senate hearing on a sexual assault accusation and the Judiciary Committee's vote, now delayed, have riveted many around the world as well. We'll get a bead on that this hour. We'll also discuss President Trump's appearances at the United Nations. Venezuela is the subject of an unprecedented request by UN member countries who want the government of President Nicolas Maduro investigated for possible crimes against humanity. And investigators in the UK say they have identified one of the men implicated in the Novichok poisoning as a highly decorated Russian colonel. Joining us this week to help make sense of what's going on around the world is Courtney Kuby, national security and military reporter for NBC News. Courtney, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
David Lawler is world news editor for Axios. Welcome, David.
Great to be here.
And Jennifer Williams, foreign editor for Vox. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We would love to take some of your questions on what's happening around the world this week, so email us, 1a@wamu.org. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream, or tweet us at 1a. Before we dive into the events at the UN involving foreign policy, I wonder if we could talk a bit to the extent to which events in the nation's capital kind of overshadowed events in New York. Courtney, President Trump took lots and lots of questions about Brett Kavanaugh while he was at the UN General Assembly this week. Do we have any extent, do we have any knowledge of the extent to which that hearing was a distraction for the president?
It's a huge distraction for him. It's a distraction for everyone at the White House, you know, and this is something that the whole world was paying attention to this week. There's no question that it gripped the United States. We saw these amazing photos online of college students gathered around televisions with their backpacks on, you know, video screens on a JetBlue flight where every single passenger was watching the Kavanaugh hearing while they were in the air yesterday. And you don't have the U.S. riveted by a story and the rest of the world existing in a vacuum. Of course, they're paying attention. And then one of the big changes, you know, there's been all these comparisons to the Clarence Thomas hearings nearly three decades ago. One of the big changes is now we have the internet. So the whole world has the ability to watch this real time. And you know, one of the things that I found really fascinating, this is the kind of event that adversaries of the United States just, you know, love to see happening. When you have a domestic crisis that really transfixes the country and the world, you know, countries like Russia, this is the sort of thing they're looking for, sowing chaos in the United States, distracting from other issues. So, you know, we saw all that happening this week.
Jennifer, I also wanted to get your sense about how the world is watching this. I mean, what difference do you think it makes to the rest of the world who sits on the U.S. Supreme Court or the machinations behind the process?
That's a great question. You know, and to Courtney's point, she's absolutely right. RT, Russia Today, the Russia government-backed English language news outlet was covering this live all day yesterday, just like, you know, the Washington Post, just like Vox, just like everyone else on the U.S. outlets. So, you know, it's particularly for adversaries who want to kind of point out the chaos and the negative, you know, aspects of American culture. This was a big deal. But you have to also remember that, again, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. And even though this has captivated Washington and the United States, a lot of other countries just continued going about their business and paying attention to their own crises. In particular, you know, in the UK, Brexit is, you know, and the kind of collapse and catastrophe that we're hurtling toward there with Brexit negotiations collapsing. That was, you know, really dominating people. And then in the Middle East, you had, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu at the UN talking about, you know, Iran having this secret nuclear facility. That's across the front pages of all the Middle Eastern newspapers this morning. So, you know, as much as we like to think that we are at the center of the world, sometimes it's also important to remember that not everyone is, you know, glued to their television screen around the world worried about something, you know, a little more removed from their daily lives in terms of the Supreme Court.
David Lawler, what's your take? I wonder if you see it kind of the way Jennifer sees it in terms of us being just one world news story. And for that matter, if maybe the appeal for the rest of the world is just kind of the pure soap opera of this, as opposed to the deeper constitutional implications for the United States.
Sure. So I took a look this morning at the front pages from around the world compiled by the museum here in Washington. And this was front page news in Colombia, Argentina, Ireland, Canada, of course. But then again, there's, you know, a whole bunch of countries for which this was maybe in the paper, but it wasn't front page news. I think, you know, if it's a big story in Washington, it's going to be a big story elsewhere, especially when you consider that this isn't just a Supreme Court story. This is part of the Me Too narrative. And so, you know, it fits into a bigger picture of not what just is happening in D.C., but what's happening around the world right now.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the the museum's page right now as you bring it up. By the way, if you want to see this, it's newseum.org, N-E-U-S-E-U-M, the Museum of News, newseum.org/today's front pages, and you can see how papers all across the country played this story. All right, let's step away from that story. We'll keep an eye on this, and if anything breaks during this hour, we'll certainly let you know right away. If you've been paying attention, you know that the hearing has already taken a series of hard left turns that were unexpected, so we'll keep an eye on it, but we do want to talk a little bit more about the UN and President Trump's address to the United Nations this week. He touched on Iran, on Israel, China, Russia, and a lot more, first during a speech before UN leaders, and then in this wide-ranging press conference that lasted almost an hour and a half. Now, during his remarks on Iran, President Trump accused that regime of, in his words, exporting violence, terror, and turmoil. Listen.
We cannot allow a regime that chants death to America and that threatens Israel with annihilation to possess the means to deliver a nuclear warhead to any city on Earth. Just can't do it.
Now, Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, responded by suggesting that Mr. Trump suffered from what he called a weakness of intellect, before adding that he felt no need to make a deal with America's president.
No state and nation can be brought to the negotiating table by force. What Iran says is clear. No war, no sanctions, no threats, no bullying. Just acting according to the law and the fulfillment of obligations.
That translation of Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani. Courtney, what do we make of this exchange? Does the back and forth this week move the needle at all?
Well, so, the U.S. position continues to be an effort to isolate Iran, right? And President Trump made that pretty clear. He chaired a U.N. Security Council meeting this week where he asked all the members to work together to ensure that Iran isn't able to acquire a nuclear bomb. And then he warned them that if people were going to anyone who failed to comply with the coming U.S. sanctions, the ones that have already been imposed over the summer and then the ones that are coming in November, that there would be severe consequences. And of course, the ones coming in November are this next round of very harsh real sanctions against that prohibit other nations from buying Iran's oil, and that any bank that facilitates that kind of a transaction is cut off from the American market. So, you know, the U.S. continuing to try and isolate Iran from the world, there was a very public display of how European nations, other signatories to the JCPOA, the Iran deal, are going to try to evade these sanctions going forward. They may try to set up this new special purpose vehicle, which would be a way that they would process payments to Iran somehow in euros and wouldn't go through commercial banks. And so that way they may not be subject to these sanctions that the U.S. is going to impose in a couple of weeks. The question is, you know, would they still be subject to these secondary sanctions? That's not really clear. But Secretary Pompeo, he came out after this talk of this potential special purpose vehicle and said, well, this is one of the most counterproductive measures imaginable, which is a very strong statement, you know, when you're talking about countries that are just trying to continue on with an agreement that they are still signatories to. So, I mean, all of this shows that, you know, the U.S. is still pushing this narrative of Iran as the biggest supporter of terror, of how they need to be isolated from the world. But it's really showing that these cracks are widening and still exist between U.S.'s historical allies, Germany, France, and whatnot, who seem to really be siding with, you know, Russia and China. You know, it's a surprising fissure that was really shown this week.
We are speaking to Courtney Kuby of NBC News, David Lawler of Axios, and Jennifer Williams of Vox. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's big stories from around the world, 1A@WAMU.org. David, the president also met with Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. That took place on Wednesday. The two of them have a pretty good relationship. They seem to get on rather well. How did that meeting go? And what came out of that, particularly after the president's remarks about Iran?
The big takeaway was that President Trump finally, for the first time, said he likes the two-state solution for Mideast peace, that was something that the Palestinians in particular have been waiting to hear from the president, and he has now come out kind of softly on that side of the equation. And, you know, even if we think—
David, I'm sorry to cut you short. I just want to clarify. To my ear, it sounded like the president— I know we have to pause shortly, so I will let you finish your thought. But sure. It sounded like the president said, whatever they want is fine with me. One state, two state, either one, whatever the most viable option is, I can sign on that dotted line. It sounded to me like that was kind of what the president was saying.
So that's been his longstanding position, has been, hey, you give me something that you can agree to, and let's make it happen. Now, you know, he said he personally thinks the two-state solution is a more feasible outcome here. And again, even if we think that he's not going to get this grand bargain on Middle East peace, what he says on this stuff still matters quite a bit. There's a huge audience waiting to hear what he's going to say, what he's going to put out there in terms of this Middle East peace proposal. And so even if we think the final outcome is not going to be, you know, kumbaya for everyone, it still matters what the steps along the process are.
We'll continue the Friday News Roundup with David Lawler of Axios, Jennifer Williams of Vox, and NBC's Courtney Kuby. We welcome more of your questions and thoughts about what happened at the UN. Also, we'll be talking about a possible investigation of Venezuela's government for crimes against humanity and why Zimbabwe's new president is getting more into golf, possibly with President Trump's help. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you on this Friday. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with David Lawler of Axios, Jennifer Williams of Vox, and NBC's Courtney Kuby. We'd love to hear from you, too, about the week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we get back to talking about President Trump at the UN, we should note we are keeping an eye on a story out of Indonesia. It was hit by a magnitude 7.5 earthquake, a very strong tremor. On Friday, ABC News reports that there were numerous strong aftershocks, including one of magnitude 6.7, also a powerful earthquake. The head of Indonesia's disaster agency said in a TV interview that there was a tsunami following the earthquake that hit Palu, which is the capital of the central province Sulawesi, as well as a smaller city called Donggala. Houses were swept away. A number of families have been reported missing and communications are disrupted. The death toll is at least 91 people, with hundreds more people injured. Again, a magnitude 7.5 earthquake that hit Indonesia today and caused a tsunami thereafter. Let's get back to the UN and President Trump's remarks there. He also accused a foreign power of meddling in America's elections. Not Russia, but China. He says China is trying to damage his political standing before the midterms. Jennifer Williams, what's your sense of why he's going after the Chinese and what kind of meddling is he referring to?
Well, it became pretty clear, you know, when he first said that, people were kind of going, well, what is he talking about? Is it like Russian meddling? Are we talking about hacking into election systems? And then everyone kind of remembered, oh, right, the Chinese government ran these massive full-page ads in local Iowa newspapers, specifically addressing farmers and saying these tariffs that your president, you know, is applying on, you know, Chinese goods and imports are directly hurting you, right? Not just, hey, they're hurting us here in China, but hey, farmers, you should talk to your president about that. You know, this is a bad idea. Aren't you being harmed? And they are. And President Trump is aware of that. I mean, his administration has taken steps to, you know, provide kind of financial packages to kind of cover the expenses and the kind of temporary, at least for now, damages that these tariffs are doing to farmers and other manufacturers as well. So Trump saw that clearly, and he, you know, got into that a little bit later and mentioned specifically these ads. That clearly irked him. And, you know, but when we look at it, it's not the kind of meddling in the sense that we saw with Russia, where it's this kind of, you know, hidden, you know, kind of cloak and dagger kind of thing. I mean, they were pretty clear. It was a huge, you know, full page ads that they took out. But, you know, it really does target Trump in a very vulnerable area. And China knows that. Right. And so do, you know, our other allies. The UK and European allies have also, you know, taken out kind of retaliatory or threatened retaliatory retaliatory tariffs on sectors that, you know, hit red states, hit Trump voting areas particularly hard as a way of playing political and diplomatic hardball.
Now, during the president's comments to the UN General Assembly, he got a reception that he, by his own admission, was not really expecting. Listen.
Today I stand before the United Nations General Assembly to share the extraordinary progress we've made. In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Yeah, that reaction during the UN General Assembly when the president spoke. Courtney, what's the reaction been to the reaction?
And then he was asked about it, and he said, well, they weren't laughing at me. We were all laughing together. We were together.
They were laughing with me.
We're having a good old time up there at the UN this year. There was actually another moment that didn't get as much attention, but, you know, after he made his comments about China trying to interfere in the U.S. midterms, the camera panned over to the Chinese Foreign Minister Yi, and he looked at the person next to him and gave him this, like, very nonchalant shoulder shrug. I mean, if there was audio of what he was thinking, then it was, you know, complete. And it was this amazing moment that I think a lot of people missed. You know, he had a couple of different times where world leaders really didn't make any, they didn't really hide the fact that they were chiding him on issues. Theresa May had another one where she pretty much outright contradicted him when he, during his speech, he talked about how he was rejecting globalism and embracing patriotism. And Theresa May said, well, you know, we countries need to work together to fight extremism. We need to work on globalism. And you know, and several countries also called out the U.S. for leaving the Iran deal. So he had certainly had a mixed reaction throughout the course of the General Assembly. But I have to say my favorite was Foreign Minister Yi. I mean, he all but rolled his eyes at the president.
Yeah, it's a long way from, you know, Khrushchev pounding his shoe on the desk, but still it was one of those moments that I think we'd remember. But David Lalla, what's your sense of what this says about America standing on the world stage in general? I mean, the president has accomplished a great deal in the last almost two years that he said he would do. He said he would pull the U.S. back further from its role as the world's policeman and being involved in every international situation. He said he would demand that other nations pay their fair share. He said he would take a tougher stance on free trade deals. And he's done that. So maybe it's just a matter of perspective. If you are a supporter of the president, you might hear that remark and be like, what the hell are those people laughing about? He did exactly what he said he was going to do.
Yeah, I was actually at the UN General Assembly this week, and I think you're probably right about supporters of the president's like this attitude he was taking. I would say I don't think there are that many supporters of the president's at this gathering of world leaders, right? Especially when you're talking about European allies. And I think a part of what's happening here is the shock factor is gone. Usually the U.S. president going in, you know, praising foes, insulting allies, saying multilateralism, you know, is a problem and we need to focus on nationalism instead would shock people. But, you know, it's more of the same from Trump at this point. And I think rather than trying to bring him around, what you're seeing now is leaders trying to give an alternative to Trumpism. And I think that was a lot of what we saw from the speeches from Emmanuel Macron in particular, Theresa May. These are people who are saying the Trump way of viewing the world is wrong. We have another way. And you know, they're putting that out there, you know, in competition with his worldview.
Let me get to a few of your comments. Matt tweeted, the Democrats have sullied our system of justice on the world stage. Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire, is among those of you who've commented on the Iran deal. News Steve Brown tweeted, we know, as do the Europeans, that Iran has consistently violated the nuclear pact. And Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire, writes, Trump is obsessed with Iranian nukes, even after he withdrew from the only means we had to really influence them. Yet he lauds praise on North Korea, or heaps praise on North Korea, which has nukes, can deliver them, and has threatened to do so. Why the unbalanced approach? Does he fear the nukes Kim Jong-un has versus the ones Iran does not yet have? Courtney QB, how would you respond to Brian?
Well, I mean, Brian he has to also keep in mind that President Trump does speak out against. He certainly has heaped a lot of praise on KJU and talked about him in ways that have been very surprising to the world and specifically to, you know, Americans. But he does talk about how North Korea needs to denuclearize. So it's not like he's saying he wants North Korea to be a nuclear power, despite the fact that that's what they have become. You could make the argument that one of the reasons that he speaks out against Iran and their development program is because he doesn't want them to get to the point that North Korea has gotten to over the past several years in their development. But, you know, it's one of these strange contradictions that we see from President Trump. There are some of these leaders, you know, that he speaks so forcefully against. And then there are others, you know, Vladimir Putin and KJU, that he seems to side with when other members of his administration take these actions that are very counter to the actions of those countries. You know, Venezuela is another one. He speaks so forcefully against Venezuela and their leadership there. But it's not backed up really by any action besides some sanctions. So, you know, his foreign policy is, it's certainly fair to call it a contradiction in terms in a lot of ways.
Well, and then also you have some leaders like Kim Jong-un, who he spoke very forcefully about last year and called him Little Rocket Man. And then so much has changed since then. One more comment about the UN before we move on and talk about Venezuela. Matt asks, I wonder if the U.S. can advertise in China to make our case publicly there. David Lawler, there is some American media presence in China, but it's a lot more restricted. I mean, that's kind of why the Chinese can advertise here, because we have a First Amendment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the, you know, President Trump has a pretty loud microphone and he's trying to make his case, in China. But, you know, it's much more difficult for from a media perspective, to make that case, because obviously the information is much more closely controlled by Beijing than by Washington.
Although, Jennifer Williams, didn't the U.S. just require a news channel that's funded by the Chinese government to register as a foreign agent? Isn't that moving forward? If I recall, it's CGTN. It's the network that used to be called CCTV America. Didn't that just recently happen?
Absolutely, that's correct. And it's kind of following along with the movement to have RT, Russia Today, register as a foreign agent as part of the kind of broader realization among, you know, the American kind of media and the American government and, you know, platforms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and things like that, that there are ways that we need to kind of be a little bit more cognizant of how foreign countries and foreign governments are peddling their influence. But to go back to the China issue, I think it goes beyond just the inability to, like, physically, you know, get in there to spread Trump's message. I think the message itself probably doesn't resonate in the way that you think it would. You know, if you're, you know, the average kind of Chinese citizen, Chinese worker, seeing President Trump kind of openly say, like, you know, we're trying to essentially, you know, break the Chinese economy, taking these steps. My colleague Alex Ward at Vox wrote a great piece about, you know, how essentially the administration's policy is to try to divorce China from, you know, the kind of global trading kind of infrastructure and the global supply chain. And so, you know, bringing that message to the Chinese people and going, by the way, we would like to stunt your growth because we want America to do better. If you could get on board with that, that would be great. Doesn't seem like the most powerful message that's really going to resonate.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. All right, let's talk about Venezuela. On Wednesday, Canada and five Latin American countries urged the International Criminal Court to consider prosecuting senior officials in Venezuela for human rights abuses. That measure marked an unprecedented rebuke of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. David, can you walk us through what's going on in Venezuela right now? Before we talk about the charges, just remind us of the kind of condition that Venezuela is in these days.
Sure. So Venezuela is going through a horrific economic crisis, which has led to a sort of mass exodus of Venezuelans to neighboring countries. So we're up over, I think, 2 million was the latest. We're seeing numbers that rival what we saw in Syria in terms of the number of people leaving Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro is very unpopular, but very entrenched as the president of that country. Obviously, it's not a functional democracy. And so the thinking of many countries is that he is not going to leave on his own, and so that some matters need to be taken in order to either force him out or to compel him to change his behavior. And we're seeing that from President Trump raising the idea of a military option in Venezuela, which sounds like an extreme step, but I've actually heard from people in and around the administration that they're saying, well, what else do you want us to do at this point? And so it's a pretty bleak state of affairs there.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering, Courtney, is what an investigation might mean for Venezuela in the context of everything else. If we're talking about military options, for example, how big of an impact do we expect an International Criminal Court investigation to have, even if they did substantiate the claims and find Maduro guilty of committing crimes against humanity?
Yeah, and it's important to point out the ICC has actually already been looking into Venezuela and the Maduro regime and into potential crimes. But the fact that these countries came together with this remarkable denunciation and said, you know, you need to look at them, that gives it some new urgency. So whereas these investigations can take years, perhaps it'll be a little bit faster. I mean, one way that this could have some sort of a tangible reaction is that if they find evidence of government crimes against humanity, the UN could invoke this responsibility to protect, which is this 2005 agreement that all UN members have agreed to step in to prevent genocide and ethnic cleansing, or in this case, what would be crimes against humanity. So we could see some sort of an actual UN intervention if they find evidence that, you know, the Maduro regime has been doing these things. And these are, by the way, crimes that have been dating back for, you know, 4 years now, 4 or 5 years. Torture, detention of political prisoners, political opponents, thousands of potential extrajudicial executions and killings. So it is possible, and one thing that I found really remarkable about this is it's not common for the countries in this region to speak out against their neighbors in this way, to make a very public pronouncement. And I think It really shows just how severe the refugee crisis has become, that these countries, it has had such an impact, these millions of people flowing across their borders, that they need to do something to try to stop it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because, Jennifer, I was just going to ask you about that very thing. I mean, it's not like Venezuela just got rough under Nicolas Maduro. His predecessor, Hugo Chavez, was no nice guy either. And I'm wondering if you have a sense of maybe what pushed the neighbors of Venezuela over the edge to the point where they felt like they needed to say something, wanted to say something, couldn't not say anything anymore. I mean, do we have a sense of something having changed to prompt this request?
It's absolutely directly related to the refugee crisis, no question. I mean, if you look at the countries in particular, especially Colombia being part of this, they're facing major crises at their borders, with Venezuela, because there are people that are, flooding across the border. And, we're seeing the kind of refugee crisis, like David said, that, we saw kind of in Europe from, refugees from Syria and Afghanistan and northern and sub-Saharan Africa. So, it's kind of hit this crisis point where it's no longer isolated to Venezuela, but it's spilling out. And it's causing major, domestic political strife within these countries, and, specifically within Colombia. There are now fights over, do we build a wall, right? Do we really tighten our immigration restrictions and kick these people out? This is going to damage our economy. We don't want these people flooding in here. So it's causing serious problems. And people are finally saying, look, we can't deal with this ourselves. We need help. It's also important to remember that the point of the ICC is to prosecute criminals in places where their own domestic system of law is not capable or willing of to prosecute them. And I think there's also a kind of an understanding that, the political system in Venezuela has become so deeply corrupted and kind of overtaken by Maduro and his allies that it is now an open question whether the actual rule of law in a way that used to, in some cases, exist in a much stronger way in Venezuela have collapsed, to the point that now it's a question that, well, does the international community need to handle this? Because, the voters and the people in Venezuela no longer have a mechanism to handle it themselves. And that's really key here.
Plenty more to discuss as we continue with Jennifer Williams of Vox, Courtney Cuby of NBC News, and David Lawler of Axios. Still to come, we will talk about the meeting between Turkey and Germany that is on the way. Turkey's president arrived in Berlin yesterday for a 3-day visit. Also want to get to a few more of your comments about the UN. Chris tweeted, "When have there ever been supporters of the U.S. at the UN? We always have been the heavy hand at the UN. Let's not pretend anyone really listens to us because they like us." Interesting point, Chris. We'll get some thoughts on your question, on your comment, when we continue. Stay close. Before we get back to the roundup, we would love your help with a special series we're launching next week. We're calling it The State We're In. Congress is often deadlocked on legislation, but there's lots of action happening in state legislatures. From immigration to healthcare to gun control, state houses and governors are moving laws forward. On Monday, we'll examine state trends in gun legislation around the country. Has your state passed a gun law this year? How did it make you feel? More safe? Less safe? Or is your state capitol debating a new gun proposal? How might it affect you? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Has your state passed a gun law recently? Tell us what changed and how it affects you. Or maybe there's a gun-related initiative that's coming up on the November midterm ballot. What do you think of it? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our new app, 1A Vox Pop, to leave us a radio-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We will share some of your stories when our special series, The State We're In, kicks off Monday on 1A. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with NBC's Courtney Kuby, Jennifer Williams of Vox, and David Lawler of Axios. Regarding the UN, Chris tweeted, "When have there ever been supporters of the U.S. at the UN? We always have been the heavy hand at the UN. Let's not pretend anyone really listens to us because they like us." David Lawler, what do you think about that? Is that true?
I think Barack Obama was a lot more popular with most of these leaders than President Trump is, if we're talking about the Europeans. But I do think there is a point to be made there that the U.S. has not always been the one to go along with U.N. decision making. We you know, go our own way, a lot of the time. I think what's different this time than last year with Trump is that, you know, people seem to have a sense last year that they might be able to bring Trump along, that you know, he was never going to be an internationalist, but maybe they could get him to sign on to some of these big agreements, to think a little bit more their way. I think that is over, and maybe that's a good thing for President Trump because, you know, he says, you know me, I know you. But I do think that, the animosity, or if not animosity, at least the disregard that we've seen for the U.S. president did seem unusual to me this week.
Perhaps, Courtney, we have to keep this in a larger context in terms of the way that more world leaders are viewed besides President Trump. Dale tweeted, "You say Trump is unpopular with European leaders, then go on to support this by stating his discord with Theresa May, Emmanuel Macron, and Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, all of whom have abysmal approval ratings, far lower than Trump's. Wake up." Courtney, what do you make of that?
I mean, well, look, Dale is right. It's not a great time to be a politician really anywhere in this world right now, right? You know, we've seen this growth of populism sweep across the entire world. So, Dale makes a perfectly good point. I will say, you know, and I actually also agree with Chris that the U.S. is often the heavy hand at U.N. General Assembly. This isn't a place where they go and make a lot of friends. But that being said, we have seen, I think what's been particularly striking about foreign policy under the Trump administration is how the people who were always the historic go-to allies, the French, the Germans, the British, you know, the ones who the U.S., no one ever really questions how steadfast the relationships were. We do see fissures. South Korea is another one. I mean, I can't tell you how many times over the years I've listened to defense officials talked about the steadfast, you know, relationship, and we see real fissures in that relationship right now as it comes to the North Korea issue. So,
although Jennifer, I wonder if, you know, how much these optics and these, you know, the likability ratings even matter. I mean, the whole point, the sole point in some ways of the United Nations is to prevent World War III. That's it. It's to give nations a place to talk before they start shooting. So does it really matter how well liked any world leader is as long as they are at the UN, at the table in some way and not in their own war rooms?
That, you know, that's a really great point, except for the fact that, you know, people still have gone to war and fought each other and shot at each other, even though they are also sitting at the UN talking to one another.
True,
So you have, you know, Russia and Ukraine both there. But I think it's kind of at a deeper level. This rift is not really a personal rift, although it is in many ways between Trump and the likes of Merkel and Theresa May and Macron. If you actually listen to Trump's speech, you know, he mentioned, and he did it as well last year, mentions the word sovereignty kind of over and over again, and really pushed this idea that you do not, other countries, you, UN, do not have the right to meddle in my country's affairs. Stay out of it. Keep your nose out of our business. And that is very, very stark kind of language that you typically historically heard from Russia and China at the UN, who, you know, will frequently pull out this kind of sovereignty argument to say, keep your nose out of our business when it comes to things like human rights or invading Ukraine or, you know, the way we treat, you know, the Uyghur Muslim minority in China, and really pushing this stay out of our affairs. This is not your business. The United States has traditionally not pushed that line and been much more open to kind of internationalism, although we still obviously will just ignore international criticism in the UN when we feel like it, just like everyone else. But it's a very stark kind of deep philosophical difference that Trump really has. And he really does seem at a kind of visceral level to connect ideologically more with the likes of Putin, with the likes of Erdogan in Turkey, and these kind of other more authoritarian minded leaders.
Speaking of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, let's move on and talk about Turkey and Germany. This week, we're seeing a state visit between Turkey and Germany, which seemed in many ways unrealistic a year ago. President Erdogan of Turkey arrived yesterday in Berlin for a three-day visit. Dave Lawler, last year, Erdogan didn't have very nice things to say about Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel. What is motivating her in terms of getting closer to Turkey?
It's a great question. And I was just surprised to see there was an actual red carpet when he arrived in Berlin for a state visit. These are two leaders who see the world in fundamentally different ways. Erdogan locked up a bunch of Germans after the attempted coup a couple of years ago. They really don't get along very well. But from the Turkish perspective, their economy is in shambles, and Germany is one of the few countries that can offer them a helping hand there. And from Merkel's perspective, obviously she's decided that she can't afford to lose Turkey entirely as part of the, you know, alliance, as, you know, being on the same team, broadly speaking. And so she has made a calculation that it's better to have Erdogan on her team, even if she doesn't agree with him, than to spurn him entirely and have that relationship break down.
Courtney, give us a sense of what President Erdogan might want in terms of warming relations. I recall Turkey was a large part of the discussion with the refugee crises that have been going on in the last year or so, as has Germany been. I wonder if that is a large part of the conversation, part of what Erdogan might be talking about at the table with Germany, using his leverage perhaps, or whether there are other issues involved.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what's very clear from this is that this is becoming a very transactional relationship between the two sides, right? Germany is a very important trading partner for Turkey. Turkey needs economic stability. They are really on the precipice of a major economic disaster, and they need Germany to help them with it. Germany, of course, has watched Turkey be a very helpful partner in the refugee flow from neighboring countries, particularly Syria. Refugees is a big domestic issue, an important issue for Angela Merkel. She needs the Turkish economy to keep going and not to fail, or else refugees are certainly going to take, and that issue is going to take a back seat. So both sides come to the table needing something out of the other. And I think that's why, you know, a year ago when Erdogan was telling all Turks in Germany to vote against Angela Merkel and her, and because she was an enemy of Turkey, I think everyone sort of put that in the back of their minds, because they need to go forward and get both of their two sides worked out. You know, one thing that I think is possible that Erdogan could bring up on this trip is urging Berlin to declare the Fethullah Gulen movement a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that Angela Merkel and the Germans will also bring up the idea of the remaining German citizens who are still in detention in Turkey after the attempted coup that David mentioned. So, you know, the idea here is they're going to reset these relations so that each side can get the business end taken care of.
And just by way of the geography, Turkey and Syria share a north-south border. Syria sits just south of southeastern Turkey, so the flow of migrants out of Syria definitely directly affects Turkey for sure. Let's move on to another story that caught our attention. this week. Margaret tweeted, "Has anyone considered Trump's foreign policy may be related to future real estate deals? We know Trump has ventured to build hotels and towers in Russia. Trump is interested in Saudi Arabia. Trump has praised North Korea's beautiful undeveloped coastline. There may be something to that, because this week, the new president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, made Mr. Trump an offer he might not be able to refuse. Land for a golf course in one of the most gorgeous places on the planet, Victoria Falls National Park. Ahead of his address at the UN, President Mnangagwa shared his business prospects at an investors forum in New York.
That offer President Trump ground to build state-of-the-art golf course. So, as you play, you can be able to see the Big Five.
The Big Five refers to game animals: lions, leopards, rhinoceroses, elephants, and Cape buffaloes. David, what's behind this offer? He wasn't kidding, was he?
Zimbabwe desperately needs Western investment at the moment. They're, recovering from, decades and decades of mismanagement there. It's a bizarre thing to say publicly, though. I am still kind of trying to grapple with what he thought he would accomplish by stating that publicly. Obviously, it's something you could see President Trump being interested in, but I'm not sure what the calculus was in revealing it.
Do you think that, Jennifer, do we think that President Trump will accept the offer, or just the prospect of easing relations between the U.S. and Zimbabwe?
Well, here's the thing. Foreign leaders have really realized that the way to get Trump to like you and to be your friend is to flatter him and promise to put his name on things. We saw this with the Polish president just, I guess it was last week. It feels like it was years ago now. Coming to the United States and in a press conference with Trump, you know, saying, "Hey, we would love for you to put a permanent U.S. military base in Poland. We could call it Fort Trump." So this is the way I see it. This Zimbabwe move is along the same lines, right? It's essentially, look, Trump's pretty easy to figure out. You flatter him, you put his name in gold lights, and you'll kind of get him on your side. We saw that when Trump went to Saudi Arabia, right? And the Saudis put a huge projection of Trump's face on the side of a building. So it's a really smart move if you want to get Trump to actually pay attention and maybe want to, you know, help you out with the things you're asking for.
Oh, and by the way, for those of you who are about to tweet me, I just looked it up on Merriam-Webster. Yes, the plural of rhinoceros is rhinoceroses or rhinoceros or rhinoceri. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Investigators in the UK identified a Russian intelligence officer as a suspect in the March poisoning of Sergei Skripal, an ex-Russian spy, and his daughter Yulia. It happened in Salisbury in the UK. The poisoning agent was called Novichok. Vladimir Putin has claimed that the suspect was just a civilian tourist. David, does this revelation change anything? I mean, Russia is going to continue to dismiss these claims. What difference does it make now that the UK says it knows that this guy was a Russian spy who poisoned an ex-spy?
But this is the crazy thing. They put these guys on TV to try and make the case that you know, hey, we were just passing through Salisbury. We heard they have a great cathedral there. And then, you know, inevitably, it's discovered that they were, in fact, what the British government said they were, which was intelligence operatives. It seems like either Vladimir Putin is just trying to stick his finger in the West's eye even more by playing things this way, or that, you know, they somehow miscalculated and thought that people would adopt this line, which seems to me unfathomable. So a bizarre sequence of events, I would say.
Another story out of Australia that caught our attention. There have been more than 100 reports of metal needles found in strawberries in Australia just this last month, the month of September. It spread, and reports have surfaced of metal in fruit in Singapore and New Zealand. Courtney, I wonder if we have a sense of how this is happening and how Australia is responding. Is this an issue with, like, tainted food or bad processing in the supply chain?
So, I mean, authorities seem to think that this is the work of these are pranks or copycats. It originated out of some origination in Australia. It spread to all six states and all throughout the, even into down into Tasmania. But it's not really clear that it's all based off of one initial event. They seem to think that this is some kind of a copycat. We have seen that the distributors are now putting their fruit through metal detectors and then marking them as checked out and safe. And I think one of the big concerns is, you know, there's video now and photos of farmers throughout Australia dumping tons and tons of their fruit, perfectly good fruit, but dumping it out because it can no longer be distributed. And there's a concern that it's really going to hurt the farming industry, both from, you know, loss of their harvests and people not buying out of fear.
And one more story before we go. Finally, our international news roundup is rarely complete without some mention of Sweden. And today's story has been described as a guided missile of pure atomic pop music. Listen.
Well, those happy days, they seem so hard to find. I tried to reach for you, but you have closed your mind.
Not the voice you expected, was it? Cher. Once again, she has turned back time. The 72-year-old singer and actor has released a new album that features cover songs of ABBA's greatest hits. Dancing Queen is out today. It includes Cher's interpretations of 10 of the band's songs, including Waterloo, Mamma Mia, and this one, SOS. Cher says the idea came to her after she performed the song Fernando for this year's sequel to Mamma Mia, which is called Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Since the news broke, Twitter has blown up, and our executive producer is a huge fan and said we had to discuss this on the roundup. And I personally, Jennifer, think it's kind of cool. I'm kind of digging the fact that Cher is not going away quietly. I kind of like it.
Oh, absolutely. Cher has not been quiet lately, actually. If you follow her on Twitter, I highly recommend it just for the sheer insanity that comes across at times. She's also, it turns out, a regular caller to C-SPAN. Turns out recently someone on one of the hosts on C-SPAN took a call and said in the middle of it, "I'm sorry, is this Cher?" And she said, "Yes." And he went, "Okay." And then just continued with the conversation. So that woman, you really can't stop her. She pops up everywhere.
Jennifer Williams, foreign editor for Vox, David Lawler, world news editor for Axios, and NBC's national security and military reporter, Courtney Cuby. Thank you all for being with us. Thanks also to KUOW here in Seattle for hosting us these last few days. We will keep an eye on what's happening out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate this weekend. Keep an ear on your NPR member station and online at npr.org. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.